that courage is really contagious. We say it, I know it's a bumper sticker, but every time somebody takes a step forward in this fight like that, there are 1,000 pairs of eyeballs watching that person and learning, and it breeds more courage. So that's what's giving me hope. I see a bad case of courage going around this country right now. And I think if enough people catch it, maybe we'll be able to rid ourselves of the real virus.
Welcome to the Practivist Pod, the practice of activism made practical.
This is the first episode of our new weekly show where we share practical ways to make an impact and help you navigate whatever comes next.
This week, we are talking about the Republican House budget bill, the effort to gut USAID. Is it safe to fly in Trump's America? And of course, what you can do about all of it.
And we couldn't ask for better guests to help kick off our show. Joining us for our interview are the founders and co-executive directors of Indivisible, Leah Greenberg and Ezra Levin.
I'm Jessica Craven.
And I'm Steve Pearson. Hey, Jess, here we are, episode one. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling well, you know, everything has to, things need to be qualified these days.
There's a caveat every time you ask that, yeah.
There is definitely. There's a large caveat hanging over us all like a sword of Damocles right now. All things considered, I'm feeling good. How about you?
I'm feeling hopeful and optimistic because I choose to be. I wouldn't be doing this work. I wouldn't be doing this show if I didn't believe that we can make it through this. But it's going to be tough. And, doing this show, I verge on being Pollyanna-esque, but I call it pragmatic hopefulness. Mm. We're not going to minimize the seriousness of what we're going through because we've never been through anything like this in the history of our nation, and a lot of people are already really hurting, and there's more of that pain to come for so many. We're going to show up every week and do our best to throw sand in the gears, to slow things down, to be a fly in the ointment and build up to the midterms, win back the House, and do everything that we can to stop this regime, this fascist takeover. And, if I didn't think we could, then I wouldn't be doing this. So.
Yep. Nope. I agree completely. It is, it is a very, very tough time. But as I like to say, I do believe we're tougher, and I do believe that the opposition is forming. It is, it's a little slower than we would like, and it's a little. But it does seem to be forming, so that's good.
It does, and we saw that this weekend. So, a lot of people are coming to this and know some of the work that we've been doing, but a lot don't. So why don't you introduce yourself and let people know about you and what you do and what you hope people will get out of this show?
So great. I will do that. So I am an activist first, Steve, as you know, and also the author of a Substack called Chop Wood, Carry Water, which has been coming out since right after Trump was elected the first time. And gives people sort of a supposed to be about 5 minutes worth of actions to take every day to sort of bolster our democracy and help Democrats and left-leaning people win elections. So that's been coming out 5 days a week for, 8 years now. Unbelievable. Oh, going on 9. And
it's an amazing,
thank you. And I do a lot of canvassing, some of which I've done with you, Steve, and phone banking, and fundraising for candidates and organizations I believe in. And I am also a content creator, so I make videos on TikTok and Instagram and a bunch of other platforms, simply trying to help people understand what is happening in American politics and what they can do about it. So that's who I am. I'm also the mom to a trans teenager, which is important to mention because LGBTQ rights are really important to me and deeply personal to my household. So I think about that quite a bit as well. Yeah. And what about you?
Well, I'm also an organizer, and I think it's important in a podcast like this that we do, where there's a lot of newsy journalist stuff going on. I don't consider myself a journalist at all. I'm an organizer. So when I approach this work, my focus is always on how do we come together? How do we build resilience? How do we persevere? Because I know that every major movement for change in the history of our country and of the world really has originated from people, and it comes from us. And right now, that's certainly the case. We are the ones that are going to have to stand up. I call myself class of November 2016. I worked in the entertainment business. I grew up in D.C. My dad was counsel to President Johnson. For those who are watching on YouTube, that's him and Johnson behind me there.
I did not know this. Your dad was counsel to Lyndon B. Johnson?
He was, yeah. He helped implement the Great Society and Medicaid and Medicare and everything that's under attack right now. My dad helped implement, so.
What was your dad's name?
Devere Pearson.
Oh, my God. Okay, well, we'll talk about this another time, but I'm obsessed with Lyndon Johnson. So this is the really big news for me. I did
there
not
we
know
go.
This. I'm starstruck.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, and I do have some great Johnson stories. In fact, on my previous podcast, How We Win, I interviewed my dad before he passed away, and he talked a lot about his time at Johnson. And I really treasure that archive. I left D.C. and came out to California, got in the entertainment business. But when Trump got elected in 2016, just wanted to turn my life upside down and do this work, largely driven by, you know, my family, you know, and the attacks on women and the uncertainty that my wife and daughter faced, and the anxiety that we're all feeling, and my knowledge that, and I say this on my old podcast, How We Win, all the time, action is the best antidote for anxiety. But it really is. Being of service is how I get out of myself, and that's how I want to live my life. So I've been doing this work for a long time, and I'm just thrilled to collaborate with you. Because, you know, we're doing the same stuff, and you know, you kind of casually mentioned the incredible newsletter, Chop Wood, Carry Water. I'm so glad to welcome in that community, because, you know, you're really giving practical, hopeful, you know, advice and actions for people every single day. It's the Lord's work, and we need it right now. So this is an amazing collaboration.
Thanks. And for whatever it's worth, the subscriber base has quadrupled in the last 30 days. It has been an absolutely stunning influx of new people to the newsletter, like shocking how many new subscribers there are. And I'm not saying that to brag. I'm saying that to say that a lot of people who maybe even during the last 8 years, when a lot of us were getting involved in activism, were still kind of like, I think I'm good, are now signing up and getting involved. And that is something that we can take some hope from. I happen to know that my stepfather called his representative for the first time ever this week. And it was over the House budget that we are about to talk about. So I'm excited. I like to see people get in off the sidelines. Not that he was on the sidelines in every way, but he had never called before. And this House budget, I think, is going to galvanize a lot of people to get involved who never had before. So,
Well, I'm a sucker for a good segue, so let's get right to it. Let's talk about our Chop Wood, Carry Water items, and as you mentioned, the first one is this Republican House budget.
Yeah, and you know, that segue, by the way, totally organic. didn't even mean for that to happen, but it just did. So so this budget, actually, when I first read about it, I subscribed to a great newsletter from the Progressive Caucus Center. It's called Unrig the Rules, and they send out these kind of breakdowns of what's happening in Congress and what bills they're working on. We can put the subscription link in our show notes. It's a great newsletter. And when I got the newsletter describing this budget, I just thought, like, this, if it weren't so incredibly serious, it would be comical that this is actually what they are trying to do. Not comical in the ha-ha, I guess comical in that it is so, like, like Disney villain bad. It's really kind of amazing. So basically,
twisting the mustache comical.
Yeah, exactly. Just beyond. And there were two versions of this budget. The Republicans were proposing two bills in the Senate that were going to be passed by reconciliation, and then one big bill in the House. They wanted to go for one big bill, and we just found out that they're going to go for the one big bill version. And because they're going to go through reconciliation, without getting into a whole explainer about that, reconciliation is a way to pass bills that have to do with the budget, and you can't be filibustered in reconciliation, so you can pass it with just a majority. So unfortunately, Republicans theoretically can pass this budget, right? If they don't lose a single vote, they have to keep everybody, and that is harder than it sounds. But theoretically, this is the budget they want to pass, and I'll just give you the bare bones of it. They want $4.5 trillion in tax cuts for rich people, right? They basically want to extend Trump's 2017 tax cuts that were about to expire. And this will be $4.5 trillion in tax cuts, not just for rich people. We are talking for the super rich, right? They want to raise the debt limit $4 trillion, partially to pay for these tax cuts. And then they also want $2 trillion, $1.5 to $2 trillion in cuts. And those cuts will largely come out of Medicaid, out of nutritional assistance to the poorest people in the country, and out of education. Oh, and out of health insurance. They want to get rid of the ACA subsidies. And so we are looking at literally attacking the poorest people in the country, taking away their health care, taking away their food, and making it harder for people to get an education, especially people who are impoverished, so that people like Elon Musk, I mean, I don't want to use him as the only example because there's how many billionaires are there in this country? There's 80-something, I think. Yeah. But so that these people and companies like Coke and Amazon and SpaceX can pay zero taxes, like none at all. That is why. So that's my rant and my explainer. I pass to you, Steve. Take a breath. Shake it off.
Fortunately, like, we don't just rant on this show. We actually have some actions for folks. And you mentioned, even though they can't filibuster it, Democrats can't filibuster it, there's still a razor-thin majority in the House. And this budget is wildly unpopular with Americans. Americans don't want their health care to be cut. They don't want their health care and health services to be taken away. I have yet to see a Republican with a spine right now to stand up to Trump. But what they do want is, self-preservation. They want their jobs. And so you've got some call scripts, but it's really important, no matter where you are, that you call your representatives, especially if you have Republican representatives, especially if those Republican representatives happen to be in a swing district. This message is very clear. You have the script, but I'll summarize. I haven't looked at it, but I'm just going to guess and summarize it. If you vote for this budget bill, you will lose your fucking job.
That's it. Yes, absolutely. And the thing about it is that cuts, especially to healthcare, poll really, really badly. If you look at polling across parties, Americans do not want healthcare cut. They think the federal government should be paying more and investing more in healthcare, not less. So the interesting thing about Americans, we're a very weird sort of fickle people. If you ask Americans, like, do you think the federal government is spending too much money? They'll say, yeah, I do. I think so. But when you say to them, do you think Medicaid should be cut? But like 80% of them will say, absolutely not. Not one penny. Do you think the Affordable Care Act should be eradicated? Absolutely not. Like, healthcare in particular, Americans really frown on cuts. And when you emphasize the fact that when you start cutting Medicaid, not only are you increasing deaths and sicknesses and medical debt, but also all of those rural hospitals, which we're barely hanging on to as it is, they depend on Medicaid. Yeah, they'll close.
Yeah.
And the next time.
Close.
Right. And these people in red districts, the next time they go for health care, they may find that they have to drive an extra hour to get to a hospital because of these cuts. So
yeah,
Republican lawmakers know this is unpopular. They're hoping Americans aren't paying attention. And it is our job to say, oh, we are very much paying attention. And how dare you? That is the phrase I want everyone to get very used to using. How dare you rob from the poor to try to give to the rich?
It's probably better than saying you're going to lose your fucking job. It'll be more effective when you call them.
I like lose your fucking job. I am all for cursing at some of these people. That's the only language they understand. So do it.
But I will, to your point, which is really good, is some of the stuff when we're really tuned into this and that we have rightful outrage about this coup, this dismantling of our government agencies and this, decimating of the workforce, honestly talking about that to a lot of the general public, who don't have trust in government, who feel like government's probably bloated, it's not very persuasive. But when we talk about the specific things that are affecting them, and this is why storytelling is so important.
Yeah.
Like, I have a close friend who is, worried about losing his cancer medication. He's living with leukemia. And these cuts could literally make it hard for him or end his ability to get the treatment that he needs to live,
Yeah.
I mean, these are personal stories that, so many people relate to, your grandparents. You talk about having to drive an extra hour. Well, if you've, you've broken a bone, you can handle that. But if your grandparents have a medical emergency, that's the difference between life or death. So,
yep.
These personal stories are what's really going to move the needle, and we're seeing that happen. This is where I have the hope. This is the pressure point that we have for these Republicans, especially with a House that is so razor thin.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, I have a sibling who is either on Medicaid right now or was until very recently, and like could not have had health care without it. And one of my closest friends, single mom, just said to me a couple days ago, if they get rid of those ACA subsidies, I don't think I'm going to be able to afford health insurance anymore. Like, I literally cannot afford it for me and my two sons without the subsidies. She was like, I don't know what we're going to do. I mean, it is really important that we understand and communicate these personal stories. And because you're right. The more general it is, the more people don't care. And the more specific it is, they start to care an awful lot. So that is a universal truth. So yeah, but it is real important for us to call. And this week, even while our lawmakers are on recess, because of course they should be taking a long, vacation right now after the last one like a week ago. It's important for us to actually be at their offices and at their town halls and in their faces saying, really? You really want to cut health insurance for poor people and food for babies so that rich people can get a tax cut? Tell me more about that. How do you justify that? I think it's important for them to hear from us loudly. So
I agree.
Yeah.
And we also want to talk about USAID. Which is, close to us. My Melinda, my wife, her dad worked for the Kennedy administration. I talk about my dad working for Johnson. He was early USAID, and Melinda was actually born in Cyprus. They were overseas helping build dams in different countries, in Cyprus and Bangladesh. And so this is part of Melinda's family's legacy, and it is, terrible in so many ways. But why don't you explain what's happening at USAID and how we can push back there?
Yeah, for I just have to say, did you hear that they just had to shut down the John F. Kennedy Library? It's shut down because of Trump's cuts. They couldn't afford to stay open anymore.
Yeah, I heard. I thought that was a willful act, but it's all willful act, he is doing everything to shut down the Kennedy legacy, except for one specific Kennedy. The bad strain of Kennedy. Exactly.
We don't have enough time in this life to talk about him. But yeah, so the USAID, I did a little bit of a deep dive on this week because I got to admit, I knew about USAID. I had a vague sense of what they did. But I really didn't know all that much about them. And obviously, when the cuts happened, we all sort of, paid a little bit more attention. And then I got an email from someone who works for USAID and has a lot of friends who work for USAID. And they were like, I'm asking you to please help get the word out. I don't think people understand how many ways USAID is actually keeping us safe, keeping Americans safe. And that is the thing that I think people are missing. People think, well, they're just bringing, you know, delivering a lot of food to poor people, which... Yes, and yes, yes, they are. And that's a really decent, amazing thing, which, by the way—
If it was solely humanitarian aid, that would be enough. That would be okay and worthwhile.
Exactly. Not to mention that 41% of that food comes from American farmers. Billions of dollars of that food comes from American farmers who are now just stuck. They have lost a source of employment. But the other things that USAID does, terrorism, they do anti-terrorism work. Their work directly reduces international terrorism here and abroad because they are working in parts of the world where young populations that don't see a stable or hopeful future for themselves are highly susceptible to recruitment by terrorist groups. And they go in there and they give them another option. They give them stability and a way to make a living that is not that. The same is true for international migration. We have all these Trump supporters who just don't want more migrants in the country. Well, guess what? More people migrate to the United States when their home is unsafe or unstable. USAID is providing that stability. And then just the last thing I'll say, but there's so many ways, like I can't even list them all here, but diseases. There is an Ebola outbreak in Uganda right now. And USAID had a team working to contain the spread, and that team has been disabled. So we're literally making it more likely that Ebola comes to our country. It is just so stupid.
It's so stupid. And no, I'm sorry to interrupt. It's so stupid, but you made a really good point about the terrorism and the anti-terrorism work that USAID does. There is a very good reason why Putin has been wanting to dismantle USAID for a long time. And that's because when there is a void in those areas, then those countries can fill that void. And that's what Putin and China want. And and frankly, you know, I've talked to some people around this as well. And like in Africa, you know, we actually have been, like, that void's been filled by Russia and China in many areas there. And so that makes the world, you know, not only do you have the void of the anti-terrorism, you know, teachings and giving folks another option, but you have active terrorist groups recruiting now and making it, you know, more dangerous. So it's called soft power. It's not just about aid. And again, if it was about aid, you know, we are a global community. That is enough. We, you know, we have a responsibility to take care of our neighbors when they're in need. That's how we live our lives. So that would be enough. But the soft power is when we are able to intervene and give aid, then we're making our country and the rest of the world safer.
Yeah, absolutely. And why are we doing it? We're doing it, again, it always goes back to, and I really want to encourage our listeners to, when you're talking to your friends and family about this, always bring it back to the tax cuts. Because all of these cuts are about, quote unquote, minimizing government waste, which this is not wasteful. It's 1% of our budget, by the way,
USAID. I think this is deeper than that, actually, you know, because it is such a minuscule amount of money. I don't think this is about, like, finding more money for the tax cuts for the rich, you know, for the billionaires. I do think this is part of a you know, global geopolitical restructuring that, you know, Russia has been pushing for a long time as well. So.
Yeah, 100%. But I think it is their cover for it, right? You are absolutely correct. That's not the real reason. But what they'll say is, well, we've got to cut this money. And then they're going to turn around and give the tax cuts. So we can call them on the absurdity of that argument and at least make them admit that the truth is not that at all. The truth is, this is a geopolitical move to help Vladimir Putin. And also it is Elon Musk's personal grudge against USAID because they, first of all, helped bring apartheid to an end when his family was a big part of the sort of, you know, was a terrible white supremacist party.
No, apartheid.
Not at all. Loved apartheid. And also because they were investigating one of his companies. I can't remember which one. So It is a stupid, dumbass move because we can curse on this podcast and we will.
yeah.
It is deeply detrimental to American interests.
You said dumbass. That was
I know
bold.
That's like hardly a curse, but I curse so much better than that, I should say. But yeah, it's just, it's dumb. It's self-defeating. It puts Americans in danger, let alone the jobs that have been lost, 50,000 or something already. And it's all being done to help Vladimir Putin and a bunch of people who basically are traitors to our country who just want to make money off of it and help Russia for reasons I don't even fully understand. And yeah, it's very fucked up.
It's fucked up. So let's talk about what we can do about it. You have a resource doc for that. Can you explain what's on that? And we have the link in our show notes. All of these, by the way, listeners, we will always put the links to these in our show notes. So we want you to click on them and take action.
Yeah, this is a great Stand with USAID toolkit that someone sent me. I think it maybe was that person. And it's got call scripts. It's got social media posts. You can take action as an individual or as an organization. You can buy a sweatshirt. I mean, this is kind of sad, honestly. Buy a sweatshirt to help raise money for the USAID staff who have been laid off and need help. I mean, it's so awful. And then they've also got USAID impact stories that you can read and then share. Because again, remember the personal stories of individuals. Here's the work I was doing. Here's why it mattered. Here's me at the, you know, SNAP office trying to get food stamps because I no longer have any money to feed my family, except, oh, the Republicans are also cutting SNAP. Sorry, I digress. But it's got some really great resources for you in it. And I highly recommend that you check it out.
Great. We all will, I know. And another thing we want to do on this show every week is talk a little bit about messaging and make sure we are all singing, you know, the same song from the same choir. So we're gonna have I don't know what we'll call the segment. It's a work in progress. It might be different what we call it every week, but right now we'll just talk about this week's talking point, and it's around these. You know, really terrifying and tragic airline crashes that have happened since Trump has taken office.
That's right. We want to take every opportunity we can to sort of hit at members of the administration because we know that these are really deeply unqualified people. So when we start to see the consequences of that unqualifiedness, that's not a word, but we're going to go with it.
I like
we want to call it
not
out.
Not as practivists for that matter, but we're using it. So.
Exactly. We're going to make up all kinds of language here. So this is we had another, tragically, another plane crash today in Arizona. This is the second fatal Arizona airport incident this month, by the way, and I think like the 9th or 10th plane crash since Trump took office. Some absurd amount, right? After a long run of really barely anything. And it is what I want to urge everybody to do this week. Like, let's just try this, right? They have Fox News. They have their huge social media platforms. But we have so many of us and our individual loudspeakers, our individual platforms. And I'm going to ask you to just talk about Sean Duffy. Who is this guy running the Department of Transportation? He is a Fox News host and a reality TV, not even star, just an actor. Like, he barely made a dent in the reality TV ecosphere. But here he is running the Department of Transportation, and we are now in a plane crash crisis. Is it even safe to fly in the United States anymore? He is in charge of the Department of Transportation, and planes are falling out of the sky. So we want to remind people that Donald Trump and the Republican Party have pushed out the FAA director. They have disbanded the Aviation Security Board. They just fired another 400 FAA staffers. Meanwhile, Sean Duffy has not been troubleshooting. He went on a joyride on Air Force One to watch the Daytona 500, I think. I don't know. He's not doing his job. Yeah. And we want to hang this around Republicans' necks because they are responsible. And they are so quick to blame things on Democrats when Democrats are in power. Well, guess what? Right now, Republicans are in all the power. This is on him. This is on Duffy. It is on Trump. And so I am going to encourage you this week to talk about that. Right? Steve?
Yep. Yep. So that's the lowest lift that anyone can do is to talk about that on social media, to push that out. Our link trees are on all everything, so you can, you know, retweet our tweets and comment on them, or not tweeting. Actually, I'm not on Twitter. I'm Blue Sky, so they're Skeets now,
skeeting.
Right? Is that what they are?
Skeeting.
Skeets.
Yep.
So we'll be skeeting about it, and that's the easiest thing that you all can do. But it really is important because, you know, the mainstream media is. Compromised at best, overwhelmed, you know, it's up to us to really get this messaging out, you know, and that's why, you know, alternative media and the stuff that we push out on social media is so important and really impactful. So
right.
That's your social media messaging. We'll come up with a better name for it, but
yeah,
for the week.
Your loudspeaker moment or whatever. But do just remember that, like, Republicans
like that.
Have a really amazing skill. They make things true just by repeating them a bunch of times, even if they're not true. They have learned that if you say something enough, it becomes true to a lot of people. And it changes the conversation. So our job is to just keep saying, you know, planes are falling out of the sky because of Trump. These are Trump plane crashes. This is, you know, this is a result of Trump decisions and Trump administration decisions, and just keep saying it over and over and over again.
Absolutely.
Who and is Sean Duffy? Why is he making planes crash? Sorry, go on. That's it. That's the last thing I'll say.
No, that's good. I was going to say we can crowdsource the name of that segment too. So hello at practivistpod.com if you have a good name.
Yes.
All right. One name that we already have that is a holdover from our How We Win podcast, and we're not letting go of this segment because it's so important, and that's Reasons for Hope. Jess, what is your reason for hope this week?
Okay, I have a really good one. So I am very worked up about consumer power because I think it is something that is a huge tool we have at our disposal. We make up a huge part of the sort of purchasing power in this country, people on the left. And I'm very encouraged to see that not only are we using that, but it's making a difference. And the article I saw this week, which we will put in the show notes, is about how Tesla stocks are plummeting in the United States, but also in Europe. And that Elon Musk is actually very vulnerable to a Tesla boycott. That his stake in Tesla comprises the lion's share of his wealth. So if consumers launch a sustained boycott, both Musk, I'm reading directly from the Slate article here, both Musk and his car company could find themselves in dire straits. Tesla was already in a precarious position before Musk's flirtation with the far right. Nosediving sales would be an incapacitating blow. And this is what we're seeing. We're seeing the stock plummet, sales start to fall, and we're seeing these protests. You know, good on all of you who are out protesting in front of Tesla stores right now. If we can make that brand toxic, this could be a very meaningful gut punch to Elon Musk that really could make him, I'm not saying it will, but could make him have to reevaluate whether he can stay involved in politics and keep his wealth. And, you know, it's all about his wealth for him. So I'm excited about it. I just think it's exciting.
I love that. I saw someone driving a Tesla here in Los Angeles last week that had a bumper sticker that said "Fuck Elon" on it.
Yeah,
I just thought, oh, like they're trying to hold on to their car and just put I had the car before. Like it was, I had it forever. You know, but anyway.
I get it. I couldn't drive one, but I do understand. My neighbors have them, and they're like, we're just going to keep them. But, you know, we hate them. And I get it.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
All right. So my reason for hope, we've sort of talked about it. You kind of stole it at the beginning of our show, was that's okay. It's, you know, it's hopeful to see people really stepping up now in this moment. As this was all going down, we were like, why are we not in the streets, you know? And when we see like Germans out in the streets protesting, you know, Trump being elected, and we're not out there, it's shameful. But, you know, over just on Monday, we had great protests all over the country. And, you know, you talk about people engaging and calling representatives and going to these town halls and blowing up the phone lines. And you know, you and I were doing this back in, you know, 2016, 2017, when we saw the largest influx of volunteers, you know, really in our history. I mean, you know, it was what built the blue wave in 2018 was massive. And now we're seeing way more than that. We're seeing more people jumping in right now because they know what's happening. Plus, we really already have the infrastructure built to take these volunteers and do things. And we talk about that in our interview with Ezra and Leah. You know, back in 2017, groups like Indivisible and Swing Left and Sister District and these grassroots groups were building the plane while we were flying it and trying to figure it out. And now those organizations are, you know, tested, they're strong. And so that all gives me a lot of hope, you know. Yeah. So I think we're setting ourselves up the right way. So,
yeah, I agree. I agree. And I think we're going to see a lot more. Yeah.
We're going to see more. And that was actually, darn it, pretty good segue into our interview with Leah Greenberg and Ezra Levin from Indivisible. Leah Greenberg and Ezra Levin are former congressional staffers and are currently the husband and wife power duo founders and co-executive directors of Indivisible. Among their many accolades and contributions, they've been featured as one of Time 100's most influential people of 2019. I believe their influence at this moment in our history is even greater. I'm so grateful for their important work, and I'm really grateful that they are helping us kick off our first episode of the Practivist Pod. Leah and Ezra, welcome. It's great to see you both.
Great to be here.
Great to be here, Steve. I'm a little bit nervous about currently husband and wife team. Maybe you have information that I don't have.
I don't know what's going on outside of this interview. It's none of my business, really. But it's a stressful time for everybody. And I want to ask you about that. I want to say, first of all, Jess Craven was super bummed not to be able to be here. She's a huge fan of you all's. And I was in your last meeting, and I think you name-checked her three or four times. So
she's great. She's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, she's the best. She's speaking at a conference in San Francisco right now, so couldn't be here. But as I said, Indivisible is really leading the way, and you are both inspiring so many volunteers and activists to own their power, take action. I want to know who's inspiring you. Where do you all get your inspiration, and who keeps you going?
Oh, God. I mean, it's not close for me. I mean, I think the reason why we're still here 8 years later is because we get the privilege and the pleasure of actually working with folks on the ground who are doing this work. I mean, maybe you'll see some of their work covered in the media and the newspapers on Rachel Maddow if you're watching. But largely, these are folks who are not professional politicos. These are, you know, nurses and teachers and IT technicians and folks who took it upon themselves to actually do the work to fight back against the authoritarian takeover of our government. And gosh, how can you see a group of people in a rural area and or a suburban area or a group of people who have never worked before together, who are coming together to fight for our democracy, and not come away feeling like, my God, if they can do it, like, we've got to keep going. We've got to figure out how to get these folks the resources they need, the support they need. So that every day is inspiring to me.
I also would say I absolutely agree. I think that one of the coolest things about this job for the last 8 years has been being part of the stories of so many people who are taking on leadership and who are stepping up and, you know, demonstrating so much courage and bravery. And I also just think we're surrounded right now by a lot of different stories of institutions and powerful people failing us or undermining our democracy. And we're also surrounded by 1,000 stories of acts of courage. If you know where to look, right? You know, if you think about the civil servants who have refused to obey illegal orders, if you think about the Department of Justice staff who have resigned rather than follow, orders that they think they understand to be illegal. And if you think about the people who are organizing around the country, like, there are just many, many people who simply are not going to let fascists take over and who are doing their part collectively to hold them back.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to get to that later, but it's up to us, really. That's the inconvenient truth, as they say. Our institutions, our elected democratic leaders, you know, they can only do so much. Every major movement for change, and every time we've pushed against fascism, it's because of people power. And you are leading that. But before we get into the work you're doing, I want to know, like, how are you doing? I mean, you have a 2- and a 4-year-old at home. How are you balancing the urgency of this moment with your own personal life priorities? Do you have any downtime with your family? How are you spending it?
That's a great question. Well, you know, in 2017, when this all got started, we had absolutely no personal lives for years. I think I took a day off for the first time in mid-2018. That's not how things work these days. You know, if you've got a family, like you gotta spend that time with kids. You gotta be there for them. You've only got so much time with them. It's one day at a time and all doing the best we can. You know, the good thing about having a 2- and a 4-year-old is that they are at an age where if they want attention, they will let you know they want attention.
Yeah.
And this is reminding you that we did not lock our bedroom door. And so Zeke, right,
so they may show up.
Take care very well.
I hope so.
At any point. I just shout out to the moms, my mom and Leah's mom,
yes,
for being just incredible sources of emotional and child support. My mom is in Texas, but she comes up periodically, especially for crisis moments. She was here around the election. She was here around the inauguration, and the kids just love her, and she's great with them. And that both gives us, well, you asked about breaks. That gives us more time to work.
I know. When is there not a crisis moment right now?
Yeah, no, I mean, we're very lucky. We got a ton of family support, but we also are part of a great team now, right?
Yeah, that's right.
When Trump was first elected in 2017, we were building up Indivisible, you know, out of popsicle sticks at the same time and trying to like create an organization and, you know, make partnerships and work with a broader ecosystem and work with thousands and thousands of Indivisible groups all at the same time with no existing, you know, infrastructure or that was a lot. Now we have an incredible team. So it's not just us, you know, staying up late at night trying to write every email.
That's right. An example of that is, you know, one of the realities of the Trump era is that they're always breaking some big news on a Friday night and trying to move forward over the weekend. That has happened basically every Friday since inauguration. But we have a system for that now. There's somebody who is on point on the team, and they're on Friday night watch. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. So it's not up to me and Leah not having dinner with the kids on Friday or not being able to make pancakes Saturday morning. There's somebody on track, and everybody takes their turn, and we figure out how we can respond as best we can.
That is a rough gig at Indivisible, the Friday night watch person, whoever. Lots of crisis moments. And it's important, like I've got into this work through Indivisible back in the very beginning. And that's how I found Swing Left and then went on to work with Swing Left. But, you know, I think if anything we've learned over these years that it's about building resilience. I mean, you talk about crisis moments, but, you know, we can't live and die by every fight. We have to, you know, keep chipping away at this and make room for ourselves in this too. So that's why I asked that, because it's a big focus for me, for all of our volunteers, to build that resilience. And I think in the last meeting I saw with you all, there was a Telecaster on the wall. I can't see it right now, but is it still next to you there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, actually, you can just see it up. Yeah, we have that Telecaster. I wish I was playing it more than I am right now. But that, you know, music has become a little bit of my a way of checking out, that, you know, I will, you know, put on, I might be watch like cable news, but also bring the guitar out and just noodle around. Or if I'm really lucky, I'll have some time just to put on some sort of backing track and mess around. That is a good way to check out for me.
Yeah. I recommend that myself. Yeah. all right. Well, let's get into the meat of this. You know, obviously, you've said Democrats need to be the opposition party, which they do. How can we support that with Democrats in the minority and the Trump-Musk regime rolling through the government with zero regard for the Constitution? What power do Democrats have to fight back? I know we're pushing electeds to withhold funding. Can we pressure the courts to uphold the Constitution? There was a recent Intercept article, I don't know if you saw it, suggesting that our lawmakers push legislative strategies to go to block or attack Musk's wealth. What's the plan? How do we all fit into it?
Yeah. I think it's, I would say all of the above right now is the short version. I think we want to do the kind of popular organizing that creates the conditions in which courts feel that they have to continue to act to uphold the rule of law. I think we want to impress on Democrats the need to take every single opportunity and work every single procedural lever to try to push back, to try to block, to try to delay, and to try to use the leverage that they have, whatever opportunities they have. I think we want to look at what specific levers do we have to pull in relation to Elon Musk, whether that is protesting outside of your local Tesla dealership or whether that is potential congressional action. I think right now, we are not going to be able to say, here is literally everything that you need to do. We do have some guides to various pieces of that, right? Here's the procedural maneuvers. Here's the different stuff that we could be looking at. But the biggest thing, I think, is just getting people into the mindset of this is a crisis. This is a hostile takeover of the federal government by a cabal of neo-reactionary billionaires who are trying to gut the services that you and I depend on so that they can give themselves another round of contracts and tax breaks and, you know, rule unquestioned. What can I do about that? Why? How do I actually wake up every day asking, what can I do? What can I do more?
Can I underline this point of what can I do? It's got to be connected with impact. Because what we know from international struggles against creeping authoritarianism around the globe is there's really only one tool we have, those of us who are in favor of democracy, and that is energetic, broad-based opposition. That is the tool. The people organized are the tool that we have. And for those of us who are talking about this and thinking about this every day, we're already there, right? We know that we've got to organize that. But our movement cannot depend only on those of us who are talking about it and thinking about it every day. Successful movements against authoritarianism depend on folks who do not wake up thinking about this every day. But we need them to be part of this. And they're not going to be part of this just to, quote unquote, do something. That is not why they're going to get engaged. They're going to get engaged because they believe in doing something they can have some kind of impact on the world. So for those of us organizing, it's very important that we not just align with people on the goal. We don't like Project 2025. We don't like Elon Musk's takeover of the government, but align on what you can actually do in your community to actually affect what's happening in the world. And that's where strategies and tactics and messaging and organizing comes into play.
Yeah. Ezra throwing a little shade to Michelle Obama, but that's cool. No, I know you didn't mean that. I heard that 80% of the calls going into Congress were coming from women, at least the last administration, and we don't have all the data on the ones that are going in now. I know from my previous work at Swing Left and my knowledge of indivisible groups in general that the vast majority of the people doing this work are women, frankly. As a guy, it's a shameful betrayal. But as you all are helping your members build their ranks, which are exploding right now, how can we bring in more men to this work?
It's a great question. It's a great question. And you know, I will start by saying, I think that is true from every indicator that we have of our own social movement. It's also actually true of most social movements in American history, right? Like historically speaking, even the social movements that had largely male faces at the front were powered by women doing the work, right? And that's true for the movements that we like, and it's true for the movements we don't like. The Tea Party was led by a bunch of very engaged women when you looked at the actual kind of organizing and organizing at the local level. So I would say, I think there is one piece of this, which is, you know, how much of that is a break and a uniquely gendered reaction, and how much of that is actually just the consistent reality of who makes up social movements. Now, at the same time, I think we kind of collectively acknowledge that the composition of the who is doing the work and the voting blocks that we saw in 2024 are starting to get closer lined up, right? That we have, you know, we're still working through the data about exactly which demographic group went where, but there's definitely kind of a broad conclusion as it relates to a growing gender gap with men showing up more for the other side. And that is a huge question. I think that we've got to like take look at that pretty seriously as we head into, you know, what are the conversations and what are the issues that we're talking about that actually pull people back and make them feel really, really part of our coalition.
Definitely. I think that there has to be more men modeling this work for other men. And like you said, you know, I always look at volunteer engagement as bellwethers in, you know, elections and campaigns. We look at Virginia to see, you know, what kind of engagement we're getting that's going to lead into the midterms and all that. I think you could probably correlate the same thing with who is engaging, you know, and what the electorate looks like. So, you know, we need more dudes to model that and be out there.
Yeah.
No, do you have anything to add to that, Ezra, as a dude?
Yeah, as a dude who's engaged. You know, here's the thing. Dudes' bread prices are also high. Dudes' right. education is also under attack. Dudes' freedoms are also under threat by this administration. I think the best way to engage people is engage them from a place of how is this impacting me personally? Mm-hmm. And the big opportunity in front of us right now, not just among Kamala Harris voters and not just among non-voters, but even among Trump voters, is there's going to be blowback from this overreach that we're seeing right now. People did not vote for Project 2025. It was pulling at 4% ahead of the election. I've never seen anything pull at 4%, but it was 4% were supporting Project 2025 heading into the election. And so for a set of people of all stripes headed into 2025 who were hoping that they could roll the dice and maybe get lower egg and bread prices, they're suddenly being served fascism on a plate, and they're going to be really disappointed. And that's true of men and women, and it's true of young people, and it's true of immigrants, and it's true of indigenous folks. It's true of everybody is going to be negatively affected on this. And the challenge for us is how do we reach out to those folks and make them understand that we're in common cause with them right now, that they can organize together to push back against us, that we might not agree on everything, that we might not agree on a grand governing strategy come 2029, but we can agree that we don't want Project 2025 wreaking havoc across our communities.
I also think we've got to move away from shame-based narratives about different demographic groups, right? I think that we have a popular tendency to kind of condense who went, which overarching demographic group went in which direction, and then be like, that demographic group, good or bad, right? And we actually need to talk to people like individuals about the interests that we have in common, and we need to convince them, you know, not that they should be engaging from a place of, you know, shame or what, or a place of kind of collective responsibility, but from a place of our interests are bound up together, right? We are actually a broad majoritarian coalition of people who collectively have an interest in our education system not being gutted, who collectively have an interest in no one stealing all of your personal data and deciding whether your grandma gets her Social Security check or not. These are, again, that's not a gender conversation. That is an everybody has the same interest. Let's all row together in the same direction conversation.
I think that's such an important point. And it is tricky because on the one hand, straight white guys like me have caused a lot of problems in this country, both recently and historically. And on the other hand, if you're building a broad-based, popular, people-powered social movement, if it's a drag to be part of your social movement, if you've got to self-flagellate and feel bad about yourself in order to join that movement, a lot of people just aren't going to join. They just will not come. And so you've got to figure out a way to engage with folks in a way that they can feel proud to be part of the fight, to be on the good side, to be a hero in this fight. Everybody wants to be a hero in their own fight. How can we welcome as many people as possible to be that hero?
Yeah. Well, you're right. And so I'm sorry, dudes, to the 10 guys who are listening to this podcast, I'm sorry for shaming you. No, I'm kidding. I will say, in 2017, when that Muslim ban came down and we were protesting in front of LAX, I went down there and happily married guy, but I thought, man, if I was single, this is the place where I'd want to be right now. Just putting that out there.
That was a major feature of the 60s protest era. That it was a social. Yeah, it was a great dating scene. People showed up in part for the cause and in part because it was a great way to meet other people.
Swipe right for democracy, right?
I do think the point that building welcoming, fun communities where people want to participate for whatever reason, maybe you want to find your, you know, your pinochle partner and not your romantic partner, but for whatever reason you were there, you want to create those communities. Y'all, the other side has the money, right?
And the
other
side...
What, and the what?
And the mega churches.
And the mega church, right? Yeah. Which are communities that people want to be part of. One thing that I think I was talking about this on the last call. I'm from the Deep South, and one thing those mega churches really get right is they reserve the parking spots at the front for people who had never been there before. They try to make it as easy and welcoming for newcomers to come in and feel part of the community. We got to do that for everyone. We got to do for that for everything. Unless you are a billionaire techno neo reactionary, you're welcome in this movement because we're working for you.
It's a great analogy. I love that. All right. Well, lots to discuss there. We'll figure that all out. on President's Day, thank goodness, there were huge protests at state capitals and other spots all over the country organized by 5501. Indivisible and other grassroots groups have seen, as I mentioned earlier, a huge increase in members getting active. This is all giving me a lot of hope because, as I said earlier, this is what stops authoritarianism is when people rise up against it. What else is coming up that will show this regime and the world, frankly, that we won't allow kleptocrats to take over our country?
I mean, we're in the midst of something all this week. I was very inspired by the 5051 protests, which are organic, grew on Reddit. It's just people heard about it and wanted to show up. There's no grand organizing plan beyond trying to give people a way to demonstrate that they do have a voice. So that was great to see. We know on Wednesday, there are going to be worker-led protests in dozens of cities all over the country led by folks who... Run the services that the federal government provides. Also this week is congressional recess, which means individual members of the House of Representatives are back home right now holding town halls or hiding from their constituents. And we are getting reports directly from members of Congress that they are being, in some cases happily, in some cases not so happily, overwhelmed by just the number of people now showing up in person to ask them questions. That is really healthy. As we move forward, though, there are going to be other big flashpoints where we're going to be able to demonstrate to our elected officials at the local level, at the state level, and at the federal level, hey, we know you have leverage and we want you to use that leverage. And what we know from the 2017-2018 period is that this is really not a switch that gets flipped. I think some people imagine what happened in 2016-2017 was Donald Trump got elected and suddenly the Democratic Party was the party of opposition and they were fighting against and that's how it went down. But in reality, Donald Trump got elected, and what we heard from a lot of Democratic leadership back in 2016 was, well, we lost. Let's cut deals with the other side. We're going to have to figure this out. That's just what happens. And what shifted them was consistent pressure in the form of the Women's March, in the form of the Indivisible doing public town halls, in the form of the Science March, in the form of DACA recipients initiating like really brave campaigns to push Democrats into formation. It was constant, repeated pressure that ultimately built not just the force that saved the Affordable Care Act in 2017, but allowed us to create a contrast with MAGA that built the largest midterm margins in the history of the Republic that, you know, swing left was a big part in driving in 2018. So the opportunity right there is real. There's not going to be any one make or break it. This is where we show up, but it's going to be building and building and building. And it's up to all of us organizing and tell people, here's how you can make your voice heard now. And here's why it's important.
Awesome. Yeah. You talk about 2018, you know, what gives me so much hope right now is that I'm already seeing like that was historic what we did in 2018 and the kind of volunteer, like new people stepping up to take action for the first time was historic. It's way more now. You know, we're seeing so much engagement now. Plus, as you mentioned earlier, Leah, we have the infrastructure set up. We're not building the plane as we're flying it. You know, we're ready to catch those folks and get them into action. So that gives me a tremendous amount of hope in a very difficult time to find hope sometimes. What is giving you all hope?
I mean, I would agree. I think that we've been in many ways in one of the most fortunate spots in the ecosystem because basically since November, people who are looking to get active have been coming to us. And so there's no space to get disheartened or depressed about what's happening, because there's just in this constant stream of people who are starting indivisible groups, people who are looking for their indivisible groups. We keep like breaking new records. I think we broke the record for most new groups formed since 2017 in November, and then broke it again in December, and then in January, and already in February we've broken it. And I think doubled our January total. I don't know. It's a lot.
There's a lot.
It's a lot. So I would say it's for me, it's very much the same thing, which is that, you know, I think we skipped the shock in 2024 that people felt in 2016. People are not shocked by Trump being elected. And so some of the big flashy early stuff that happened in 2016, 2017 didn't move the same way. But that doesn't mean that a lot of people did not grieve and then move swiftly into figuring out what they could do locally that would be effective. So for us, it's been just a fire hose of energy and organizing coming at us basically since November.
I 100% agree with that. The thing I would say about hope is you have hope not when everything is going great and you're fine with how things are and you think things are going to turn out well. The reason for hope is because things aren't good. Because there are quite a few folks predicting that things are going to get worse. So that when you ask what gives you hope, where that hits me is we are in a really frightening situation right now. And I don't want to sugarcoat that. I don't want to tell everybody that it's going to be okay, because it's not. A lot of people have been harmed and a lot more folks are going to be harmed. And it's anybody's guess where this is ultimately going to end up. We just don't know. If you listen to folks like Timothy Snyder, historians like Heather Cox Richardson, what they say is, look, this is arguably the most dangerous time in our republic and certainly modern American history and perhaps ever. So where does hope come in? The place where I find hope is when I see courage out there. I mean, that's what gives me hope. And I see courage in communities across the country right now. Folks who do something as simple as calling their member of Congress because they've never done it before. And that's a scary thing to do if you've never done that before. It means showing up at a protest in a red state where you don't know if they're going to accept protesters in public. It means putting your name out there in an environment of creeping authoritarianism and taking a chance and saying, well, I've got to do this, because if I don't do this, who else will do that? And there are a million instances of that kind of courage that we've seen in across the country in the few short, or feels like long, weeks of this second Trump term. And that courage is really contagious. We say it, I know it's a bumper sticker, but every time somebody takes a step forward in this fight like that, there are 1,000 pairs of eyeballs watching that person and learning, and it breeds more courage. So that's what's given me hope. I see a bad case of courage going around this country right now. And I think if enough people catch it, maybe we'll be able to rid ourselves of the real virus.
Amazing. Lee and Ezra, thank you so much again for your incredible, important leadership and work, and thanks for being here.
Thanks, Steve. Great talking. We'll talk again soon.
So we want to take this opportunity to celebrate the practivists in our community and feature your stories.
Right. So call in. We have a call-in number. Leave a message to 818-824-4286, and we might play that comment on our show. You could also send us an email to hello@practivistpod.com.
And as we mentioned, there were protests all over the country on Monday, so we wanted to just talk about a couple of the great signs we saw. Mainstream media did cover the marches, which is great, but they have basically moved on at this point. So it's important to keep amplifying our work. My favorite sign, my sister went to a march in Fresno, and I posted this on my Instagram. She had a picture of a guy holding a sign that just said, "Let's go back to 3 branches and 0 Nazis." And I thought, you know what? That summarizes it perfectly. 3 branches of government. Well, right now we have basically 1. And we've got several too many Nazis in the administration. I just thought that was a really good sign. I also saw a sign of Elon Musk as Nero. I thought that was really incredible. I've actually compared this. I've called this period our Caligula period to my husband, because I do like the Roman history. But Nero also works really well as this crazy emperor figure who is abusing people horribly and is basically crazy. Yeah. So those were my favorite signs. What about yours, Steve?
Well, I want to go back, first of all, to the let's go back to Three Branches and Zero Nazis sign. So if you're watching on YouTube, you can actually see this gentleman's sign. I will describe it to our audio listeners. It's a big piece of fluorescent yellow letter with barely even a Sharpie. So clearly the guy is a writer who came up with something really witty. So, you know, like kudos for the perfect message. Style points are a little lacking, but I like it. it doesn't have the artistic fervor that the Nero portrait does. I mean, that is something that someone really put a lot of time into.
This and is I substance like his crazy over style here, Steve. This is substance over style, this one.
And I just also am putting up a picture here. You're not actually seeing this, but of my local protest in North Hollywood, where a bunch of friends came out, and we saw some really big ones. We saw some big ones at the Capitol and all over the country, but that these other protests were just happening in cities all over the place really made my heart blossom like the Grinch, because when we have community with each other, that's really how we're going to get through this. We have the wide actions that we do that are going to get more of the press attention, but then just being in our local community together during these times, that's where we're going to build resilience. And I was excited to see that happen too.
It's great. Keep sending in your stories. Keep sending in your signs. Keep sending in, just stories of things you're doing to stir things up and fight back. We want to amplify it.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Don't forget that all the links to our actions are in the show notes. So don't just listen. Click on those links and take action. Share your show with our friends and family members and make sure they are taking action to help us win. If you're able to support our show on Patreon or Substack, we would be very grateful for your help, and you will get an ad-free version of our show as well. That link is in our show notes. And please rate and review our show on Apple or wherever you are listening. This really helps us reach more people. We will be back next week with more Practivist Pod. And until then, don't forget, hope is in action.
Bye-bye. It won't be long. We will build a better world. Hold on. Stay strong. It won't be long. Yeah, yeah. We will build a better world. Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.